The SparkFile podcast may contain profanity and other adult content.
Please use your discretion.
When I bump into something that inspires me, I dump it in my SparkFile. Could be something that I want to make or how I want to be. I pump it in my SparkFile. I jump into my SparkFile. Let's open up the SparkFile.
Welcome to the SparkFile, where we believe that everyone is creative, but smart, creative people don't go it alone.
I'm Laura Camion.
And I'm Susan Blackwell. If you're joining us for the first time, you are so welcome. If you're joining us for the 1,000,000th time, you are also so welcome. But you first timers may be asking yourself, what exactly is a spark file? Where do I get one? What do I file in it? These are such good questions, and we actually do have answers.
A spark file is the place where you consistently collect all of your inspirations and fascinations. And if you're like us and you're making stuff all the time, you know that sometimes the wellspring of inspiration can run a little dry. We're here to refill it.
We are. We are on the lookout for fresh ideas, images, and inspiration that spark our creativity and pique our curiosity. Things that inspire us to get up off of our asses and make things like this podcast.
Or theater that spotlights the best artists of our time.
Or a film that captures strange and subtle human dynamics.
Or an opera that celebrates great music, stagecraft, and acting.
Or a play that you've been intending to write for years and you finally have time to finish due to the pandemic.
Or a garden that you lovingly tend with your very own hands. On today's Makersode, we're going to talk to someone who truly sparks us.
And that special someone is Sir Richard Eyre. Richard, welcome to the SparkFile. Welcome, welcome.
Hi.
We're so happy to talk to you. We're so happy you're with us today. I think you're the first knight that we've had on the show, but hopefully not the last. Mm-hmm. But we're just so honored to have this time with you today. We want to ask you a question that I've actually asked you recently. I've asked you this before, but I'm going to ask you again. Where are you right now, Richard? And how are you right now for reals?
I am in the south of a county called Gloucestershire. I am in a house which is south-facing. It's on the side of a quite steep hill. I have a garden that's terraced downwards. It's about 3/4 acre. Every room in the house faces south, so we get a lot of light, a lot of sun. And because it's on the side of a hill, it's very sheltered. And we've been living here on and off for 27 years, we being me and my wife, who is a TV producer called Sue Birtwistle, who produced Pride and Prejudice and Cranford.
Thank her for us. Thank her.
I will.
She gave us the gift of a good-looking man rising up out of water.
Yes, true, true.
Oof, those are some big gifts she gave us.
Give her our best.
But this sounds a bit idyllic, what you're describing. How's it been living there during a global pandemic?
Shamefully idyllic.
Yes. It sounds like it. We're wonderful. All joining you.
Yeah. And the real, the pain has been the fact that my daughter and husband and my two granddaughters have been in London and unable to visit us. So we weren't able to spend Christmas with them. And we miss them terribly. The addition to our household is a Labrador Springer Spaniel Cross puppy that came to live with us in November. And she is really fabulous and constantly energetic. And after I finish this talk, I will have to take her out for her second walk of the day. So she keeps me very fit. She takes me for walks twice a day.
That's wonderful.
So lovely. That's another gift.
Was that dog a puppy? Or was that dog?
She is a puppy.
What a project.
We got her when she was 8 weeks old. So she's now 4.5 months old, nearly 5 months
old. Oh my gosh. That you have your work cut out for you there.
Sure.
Listen, before we go much further, we have a request, and that is the SparkVile price of admission. Can you tell us a creative risk that you've taken recently?
Yes, I can. I've been here since mid-March last year, 2020, when I had two shows on in the West End of London, and they closed overnight. Oh. So I went from quite a more than adequate income to an income of virtually zero. I have spent the last year doing a lot of gardening, but doing a lot of writing. And I've written two plays that I had in mind, I've had in mind for several years. Now, I last wrote a play that was on in a theater 50 years ago, slightly over 50 years ago. And the reason that I hadn't written these plays is precisely because I didn't want to take the risk.
And
I didn't have the time just to spread out and take the risk to do something that could fail in a not an obvious way, because a play by definition isn't public until it's performed. But these were two plays that I felt very strongly about. I hadn't written also because I worked so much with very, very good writers, young and old playwrights. And I always think I'm directing them. You know, they're better than I am. What? Why should I try? And although I know a lot about playwriting, I had been wary of it. I simply wasn't prepared to risk failure. And a failure that in the end was failure in my mind rather than the mind of the public. But fortunately, the plays now, one has been bought by a producer and will be performed in spring of next year, and the other one will be performed in the late fall of next year.
Fantastic.
Richard.
So not wasted time.
You are not fucking around.
You are not
fucking around during a pandemic, but also, how old are you, Richard?
I'm 70. Am I 77? Yeah, I'm 77.
This is usually I'm like, how old am I exactly? But also, I think there are some people, we'll get into it, but you have had this extraordinary creative life. And I think there are some people who would sort of get to a certain age and say, I might be one of those people who's sort of like, I'm good. I've done the heavy lifting. But that you are still doing things that scare you and putting yourself out there in ways where, I mean, this shit's getting real. This is going to be produced and performed. And that you are putting yourself out there is so fucking great. I love it.
Good.
I have a question about that, actually. I want to dig in a little deeper. You said, like, you had been scared to do it for obviously many, many years. What exactly shifted in you? Like, was there a moment that you were like, you know what? Fuck it. I got to get these stories out, you know?
No, it was exactly that. It was, fuck it, I've got to get these stories out. Because, you know, time was spreading out. There was a sort of limitless spare time.
And
I had been working consistently week after week, month after month, year after year for a long, long, long time. And I'd been doing theater and film, TV and opera. And then everything just stopped. Mm-hmm. And so I could hear the sound of silence, and I could fill my day to a certain extent with gardening, certain extent with reading. But then I had these sort of bacilli that had been I'd been nursing in petri dishes for years, and I just thought, why don't I try? And then I tried I tried the first play, which I'd had in mind for 20 years. And that came off, and I sent it to a friend who gave me some good notes, and I revised and revised it. Then the producers bought it. And then the second play was a play I'd had in mind since I met a friend of mine told me a story. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to tell you what the story is, but a friend of mine who's an opera singer told me a story about 5 or 6 years ago that was so arresting. And I thought immediately, I've got to write this as a play. And I'd written notes for it. But of course, I didn't, because lack of time, but also lack of nerve. So after I'd written the first play, I thought, oh, well, fuck it, I'll do the second one.
Might as well.
Yeah. But what you're talking about is your friend told you a story and it was a hot spark. And you recognized it as such because you've been around a lot of great artists and great writing and great sparks in your time. And you recognized it and you were like, I'm going to take this time that I have. And by God, I'm going to get this thing down on paper. It's so great.
It's interesting, the conversation about time, because I think for a lot of people, if they're willing to do the self-examination, they're looking at like, oh, I had used time or the lack of time as a reason for a lot of things that I have not, you know, been maybe brave enough to do. And now
I think that's
taken away. Yeah.
That's true. But there's also allied to time is a sense of compulsion. You know, two or three years ago, I started to write a lot of poetry. And I wrote and wrote, and over a period of about 4 months, I wrote maybe 50 poems, and I published a book of poetry. And the irony is that I felt compelled to put these poems down, to write these poems, and yet since writing them, I haven't felt the same urge. I haven't been compelled to write whatever my thoughts are in poetic form. And the same with the plays. I felt compelled to write the plays.
Yes.
But if you say to me now, do I have in mind another play? No, I don't. Nor do I have the compulsion to seek another idea for a play. Mm-hmm. All I want is to work. And I shall start directing something later in the year, and then I'll do my two plays, direct my two plays next year.
So will you direct the plays that you have written?
I will direct one of them, the first one.
Awesome.
And I will direct the second one with a friend of mine, Stephen Daldry.
Amazing. Wow. Amazing.
So Stephen likes the play very much and is very keen that I co-direct it with him. Uh-huh. And when I said, well, couldn't he just direct it and I'll be the writer, he said, no, I want to spend time working in the same rehearsal room as you.
Very smart. Very smart, Stephen Daldry.
Yeah, you don't always get that opportunity, you know, to work together in tandem in that way. So exciting.
Never.
Yeah. That's amazing. There's a few things I want to just unpack in what you've shared. First of all, whether you're Sir Richard Eyre or you're one of the people listening to this podcast or one of the people making this podcast, that what we call the vampire of comparison, that whispers in your ear that Shakespeare, Sondheim, and Sedaris did it before you and better than you, so why bother? It's that can be really real. And we love that you may have said, I am surrounded by writers young and old who may be able to write this play better, but that you took the time and you did it yourself is great because it really does defy that vampire of comparison. So gold stars for you. Mm-hmm. And also, if you're listening and there's something that you have wanted to make and you feel like it's too late, you've been thinking about it too long, it's been in your proverbial petri dish for too long, or you're too old, or you're whatever the time excuse is, please take a page from the book of Sir Richard Eyre and know that you're right on time. you're right on time. Now, writing takes work and you have to show up and you have to put your butt in the chair and do the work, but you're right on time.
Yeah.
So true. And I would say that those risks officially admit you to the Spark File.
You are admitted.
More than qualifying you. So welcome. For people who don't know you, can you tell us, like, how do you identify creatively?
I usually say I'm a theater director. They look puzzled and they say, would I have seen anything that you directed?
Oh, God.
And then, I mean, it happens when border control in the States, but
yes.
I always say I'm in show business and they brighten up. Oh, really? Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And I say, well, I've just, I'm here because, a movie I've made is opening. They say, what? And I'll say, because they won't have heard of it, I'll say, oh, it's a movie starring Judy Dench. And they go, oh, yeah, Judy, great.
yeah,
thanks, Judy.
So that's, I don't expect people generally to know who I am and what I've done and have an eye on my artistic life. Mm-hmm. I really don't. So, I think you have to be extremely celebrated. I mean, you almost have to be adjectival, in the sense that people talk about,
yes,
yeah,
Pinter-esque.
Mm. Yes.
Because, yeah. Harold Pinter, Pinter-esque has entered the language.
Yes.
Or you have to be, a surname person. Pinter.
Uh-huh.
Stoppard.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Tarantino.
Tarantino. But, I'm absolutely not. I'm just a guy who has done a lot of stuff. And I don't even think I've had a career. And I slightly bridle at the suggestion that people have careers, because a career suggests some sort of advanced calculation about, people talk about the arc of your career. But actually, we don't. People like me don't have careers. They have. You do a piece of work. It either works or it doesn't. You do another piece of work. And gradually you acquire a reputation, if you're lucky, for consistency. But it is true that, you're as good as your last piece of work. And that's how I feel, is that I get no solace looking back at my resume and say, that was a success. That was a success. If the current project isn't successful, there is no solace in the past.
I'm curious about that concept of like some sort of calculated plan. Do you think at all about that in terms of, let's say, like your last project was a success? What's running through your mind in terms of your next project? Is it just needs to be something I'm passionate about, or is there a sense of, like, I guess, trying to build upon the last thing you did?
I think you have to. No, there's no sense of building on the last thing. Each project is, unless it's directly related to an earlier project, each project is autonomous. It's it's its own. It's its own universe, and it has its own natural properties and laws. And your job as a director or creator is to bring that universe to life, to people it, to occupy it, and to make it functional.
In the things that you're saying, I'm formulating a hypothesis. I'm not quite there yet, so I want to learn more about this. I'd love to turn back the hands of time a bit. Can you share with listeners where you're from originally and a bit about the family that you grew up in?
Sure. I was born in North Devon, which is in the extreme west of England. We moved when I was four to Dorset, the county of Dorset, which is in the extreme south of England. I grew up in a small village. The nearest town was about 10 miles away.
Yeah.
My father was in the Navy. I was born during Second War. So he was in the Navy for, he retired quite early and became a farmer. So I grew up in rural Dorset, which was in those days very remote. Maybe it's only 120 miles from London, but felt it could have been in a different century. And I went away to school when I was seven. And it was a very isolated, culturally isolated. My parents didn't go to plays or movies or concerts or art galleries. So I didn't know any of that. And at my school, certainly till I was 16, 17, I studied science subjects. And in fact, I got into university to study natural sciences. And then I had a huge, I was sort of capsized. I had a conversion and became obsessed by literature and the theater. And the big occasion for me was seeing a performance of Hamlet at the England's oldest theater, the Bristol Old 18th Century Theater. And I saw Peter O'Toole play Hamlet. This was in the 50s. I was about 16. And I was overwhelmed by the experience. It was just something that spoke to me in a way that nothing had before that. And I became, I mean, I really didn't know the play, hadn't read the play, hadn't studied the play, because I was doing sciences. And then I switched to literature and without regret.
You just switched tracks right there, like changed your major and said, I'm going all in on this.
Yeah, I did. Well, I, you know, I was quite lazy and quite opportunistic. I really, you have to believe me. Until I left, I went to the University of Cambridge. Until I left university, I didn't really start to study. I didn't really start to work.
Yeah,
I started to read systematically. I started to listen to music. I started to see every play I could, to read every play I could. So in some ways, I'm self-educated.
This makes sense to me. I feel like I didn't learn how to learn until I was out of graduate school. And then I actually learned how to learn. But I think there's something about, it just felt like grazing at a buffet. And then left to my own devices, I started to hook into, like you were saying, literature, music, people, etc., who really sparked me. And not just what the teacher was suggesting that we read on the syllabus, but things that, you know, really started to follow my own passions.
Yes.
When you say systematically went about it, can you tell us more about that? And let's say someone's listening right now who's like, yeah, I think I want to teach myself more. You know, where did you start? Did you start with the classics or a particular playwright?
Well, or just take music. I had, as a teenager, was very into rock and roll, Elvis, Buddy Holly, that whole generation, and blues singers, and so R&B and jazz. I knew nothing about classical music. Then I thought, I know nothing about classical music. So I started to systematically, in the sense I'll go alphabetically.
As it
happens, that's quite a good choice if you're listening to classical music, because you start with Bach.
There you go. I was like, who's at the top? It's Bach.
Beethoven. So you go, you know, Bach, Beethoven, Brahms, Bruckner, Britten. So
that's very rich, the Bs. That's very good.
The Bs are. And then I would, you know, I guess I went off after Chopin. I went off course after that, but I still find that I have a huge collection of music on my laptop, But if I hear a piece of music on the piece on the radio, and I don't know it, I immediately download it. So, I've got an encyclopedic collection of downloaded music. As far as literature is concerned, it was reading all the. I was studying English literature, so I did have to read, you know, the 19th century novels. I had to read the metaphysical poets, you know, John Donne, and I had to read Shakespeare. So it was then just more of the same. And then anything, and I still am a magpie. Anybody?
Yes.
I have a lot of friends who are writers, several who are novelists, who say, have you read X? I've recently been reading a lot of German novels on the advice of a friend of mine, Ian McEwan.
I would imagine Ian McEwan gives some good advice on what to
read. Yeah, he does. And he lives near me. So I see him, well, less over the last year, but we talk quite often. And I more or less read whatever Ian recommends.
That's good guidance to go by.
What you're describing is simultaneously you're somebody who is filling your spark file with things that give you a feeling, things that light you up intellectually, things that light you up viscerally and emotionally, whether that's music or literature. And I can only imagine that you are then drawing from those things for your productions, for instance, if you're thinking about what music are we going to use as a oral bed in this theater production or in this film that I'm directing, that you are always bringing in inspiration. And then you're somebody who's not, there are people who have wonderful lives that just are consumers of culture. And then there are people like yourself who are taking that and metabolizing it back into your own work. It becomes an investment in your own creativity.
Yes, but you make it sound as if it's a sort of calculation that this is research. It's like, collecting. I mean, I have a vast collection. I'm obsessed by books, and Amazon has been nothing but a disaster for my balance. But I don't look on these things as you know, music and pictorial references, you know, paintings and so on.
Yeah.
I don't look at them as sort of creative fertilizer. I just love to consume them.
Yes, absolutely.
If something within them trickles into the work I'm doing, well, then that's great. But obviously, specifically, if I'm working on, I mean, for instance, the last play I directed would be the year before last, was a play by a friend of mine called Nicholas Wright, and it was called Eight Hotels. And it was about racism in the States.
Timely.
And so I did do a lot of research and, looking at photographic research, reading contemporary accounts. And the character at the center of the play was Paul Robeson. And so I had to do, research on the life of Paul Robeson. And that's specific reading and research, but that's not the same as just, reading fiction and reading nonfiction that is just part of my landscape.
Yeah, I agree with you. And Laura and I, and we're always encouraging our listeners as well to have your eyes open and look for those things that do light you up, not necessarily because there's a direct dotted line to a specific project you're working on, but because it is what
makes you feel alive.
Yeah, feeds the soul, makes you feel alive. And that I do think is even indirectly fuel for an artist. It is fuel mm-hmm. for creativity and in ways that we don't even, couldn't even say or articulate specifically around a project. Yeah, I think that's great.
Yeah, I think that's true. But, you know, we're not, people who do creative jobs are not a different order of person. They're not, there's a tremendous romanticism, I think, about, you know, the job of artists. And, you know, to call yourself an artist is in some way self-aggrandizing, unless you mean artist in the sense of a visual artist. But I always find it sort of slightly absurd when in the music business, people are called, you know, recording artists. And, but on the other hand, you are people who are making a life out of creativity are by definition doing something original, even if it's mm-hmm. only in a very, very small and modest way. By mm-hmm. definition, it's something that can't be done the same way by anybody else. And those who are prodigiously talented, obviously, it's completely obvious that, you know, there are certain people who can mm-hmm. do certain things that are beyond our capability. And I guess that's why we romanticize the role of artists, because those who do it, you know, the Shakespeares, the Rembrandts, the Matisses, do something that is out of the ordinary, out of the mm-hmm. normal, and or certainly beyond our capability.
Richard, do you feel like your upbringing in Devon contributes to the like slight allergic reaction to phrases like recording artist? Because, you know, you're somebody who you grew up in a rural environment and you weren't born with a silver spoon in your mouth. And as you said, you had this sort of transformative experience seeing this play when you were in your teens. Do you feel like some of that feeds that sort of like slight allergy to a phrase like recording artist?
Yeah, I think my bullshit detector is very, it's maybe even over-calibrated. And, you know, I can still hear my father, who he went to Naval College when he was 13. He was a very intelligent man, but he kind of resented any form of what he saw as intellectual bogusness.
Yeah.
And he never warmed to Shakespeare, and he would say, in order to provoke me, he would say, Shakespeare is shit. And I knew it was fatal to argue with him because, you know, if you don't get it, you're not going to persuade someone by argument.
More about it.
No. So, but I think I have enough of his character within me, good and bad, that the residue is a strong dislike of a bogusness, a strong dislike of bullshit in any form. Yeah. And there's a lot of it in, you know, as much in our world, in the world of the arts, as there is in the world of politics.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. True. I wonder sometimes in America, if we've gone like the other way, because like Sir Ken Robinson talks about, like, in our education system, we have like devalued creativity and devalued the arts so much that there's a little bit of a an attempt, I think, to like reclaim that. And maybe we're overzealous in the reclaiming of the word artist and applying it to any act of creativity as opposed to, you know, the Matisses of the world. But I do sometimes wonder if it's like a reaction to that devaluing, that people are kind of overcompensating for it.
I think so. And I really hate the sort of global philistinism that, you know, the putting a price on everything, the mm-hmm. money and management and marketing are the sort of presiding gods of our world, and that things that aren't quantifiable, that mm-hmm. the arts, which actually are weapons of happiness, are devalued because, precisely because they can't, you know, there is no metric for them. You can't say, I mean, people do say, and it's true, that teaching drama at schools and participating in drama improves children's mathematics. It's true. It's true. But, you know, the idea that you would teach subjects that simply improve people's lives, that actually make people happier, make people understand the world better, that is an argument that absolute seems to have no weight at all. And I think that's a major tragedy.
It is. I completely agree. That makes me want to ask you another question about the idea of metrics and each project that you do, this autonomous project in and of itself. How do you personally measure whether or not it was a success to you and for you?
Well, you can't, because I work in performance arts, you can't ignore, you know, if you make a film that nobody wants to see, you have a job convincing yourself that the film has the merits that you believe it. And the same in the theater. But it's not a perfect metric. I can think of things that I've done which haven't gathered an audience, but I think are among the best things I've ever done. So it depends also where your play. If you do a play on Broadway or the West End or a musical and it doesn't capture an audience, then you have to say it is a failure, because you failed in the world where the metric is the number of people who pay to see it. So if nobody pays to see it, then you failed. But there are other things that, you know, there are other values, there are other measures of success.
And what can you name them for you if you were like, okay, no one bought a ticket to that. However,
it was done in perfect good faith, which is, to me, is important, but it had qualities that I think weren't sufficiently regarded at the time and should have been. And I regret it. And there are two or three projects I can think of that didn't get the acclaim that I thought they deserved. And I still think that. Whereas sometimes I think years later I did something that wasn't well received. And now I think, it wasn't well received, but then
maybe you know,
it wasn't terribly good.
Finally relaxed on that. Like, you know what? Yeah. They might have had a point.
Yeah.
I just wondered if you'd be willing to tell us what are those projects that you still to this day are like, I'm really proud of them. And I stand by it.
I would say, I mean, if you do films for TV, I guess they are, you know, tend to be yesterday's newspaper. I did a film with Alan Bennett, based on, I mean, his version of Kafka called The Insurance Man, which starred Daniel Day-Lewis. And that was in, I guess, the mid-80s. And I think it's the most wonderful film. And of course, it's, I don't know if you maybe can get it on YouTube. If you can, I strongly recommend it.
There's I'm a spark. Looking it up. I just there you made go. A note. Yeah, I'm looking that up.
Okay, it's called The Insurance Man, but I think that is a classic. The thing with theatre is, of course, that theatre exists only in the memory. So it's not, it's sort of neither here nor there to say, oh, I did something wonderful in the early 90s, and I wish more people had seen it, because it's gone, and that's the nature of theatre. And one of the things I like about theatre is that it exists only in the present tense. And one of the things I don't like during lockdown is that you get a lot of theatre, or what purports to be theatre, which is just video recordings of theatre. Mm-hmm. And I find them unsatisfactory as film and unsatisfactory as theatre, so I can't really watch them. Mm-hmm. Unlike opera productions, and I guess because they're bound together by the music, and because opera is essentially a non-real medium that has its own laws of creativity, but it's not competing with movies, with drama, because
that's right.
Drama is, you know, no, is spoken drama, whereas opera is at the opposite end of the spectrum.
The other thing about opera, watching the Met on demand and things like that, it's sort of like having the best seat in the house for the opera.
It is. It's really well done.
Yeah. And so there's something about it that almost, I enjoy going to the opera and seeing the opera live, but there's something about having that really good virtual seat for those recorded operas.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
And I did a production of Carmen at the Met.
Yes.
And it was very, very well recorded. And it's still available. You can get it online.
That's satisfying.
And I recommend that, because it's the music is fantastic. It's brilliantly conducted by a very young conductor then, who is now music director of the Met. And it stars Elena Garancia as Carmen. And I think she's matchless. It's the the best,
you were saying,
Carmen I've ever seen.
That she's such a good, in addition to being a wonderful opera singer, she can also dance and she can act.
Yeah.
And I was like, there's a magic trick for you. That is a special human being. I want to jump back a little bit, because I am so fascinated by this. And I'll tell you why I'm fascinated by it. I for a long time believed that Laura grew up in the Midwest. I grew up in the Midwest in a very rural environment. And I really did believe there was some other place, some golden palace, where the great artists and makers and creatives were making the great work of our time, whether that was Tony Kushner or, you know, historically it was whoever it was. It was somebody, but it wasn't me. And then I realized, as I grew more and made more of my own work, that actually there is no golden palace. There is no magical other place where the great artists and thinkers are doing this work. The golden palace is wherever you make what you're making and you make the thing that you want to make. You're somebody who grew up in this rural environment. You had this sort of epiphany watching O'Toole in this production of Hamlet and having this transformative experience. And you've shared with us a little bit about how your creativity was cultivated. Can you tell us how you come from your background and your leadership skills have been so honed? You've creatively led some of the most significant films, theaters. So how did you grow into being that leader?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I really don't know.
How the hell did this happen?
Exactly. when you were talking about Midwest, I was thinking of a play that I did that was on in New York at the beginning of last year, called My Name is Lucy Barton, which, of course, is adaptation of a most wonderful novel. But that's slightly her journey. She's a great, great novelist, Liz Strout, and she's written maybe 10 novels, and they're either set in the Midwest or set in rural Maine. And they describe very much what we're talking about, of, you know, growing up thinking that everything is happening elsewhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's still, I don't feel that now, but I think I did for a very long time. And for a very long time, I felt a sort of mild form of envy that somebody is having a more interesting or, you know, fulfilled, creatively successful life. But, you know,
it's hard to imagine, but okay, we're with you.
What I think cured me was when I became director of the National Theatre in the late 80s. I'd been a director of theatres before. I mean, you asked about leadership. I can't answer that except that I knew that I could do it. And then a consultant said to me once, when I was early in my time at the National Theatre, he was doing a report for the board of the National Theatre on their structure, leadership structure at the National Theatre. And I said to him, well, I know nothing about management. And he said, no, on the contrary, you know everything about management. And what you know is what managers die to learn and they pay to learn. Mm. And you learn it because you started at a very early age, I mean, 23, 24, directing people, a room full of people, and making them work towards the same end and work, you know, people of very different character and abilities, melding them together into a social unit. So your experience is making groups of people, making model societies, if you like. And and I think one of the reasons I'm drawn to that is because my family was the absolute extreme, the opposite to a model family. And so I've always envied the idea of family. And the great thing about families in theatre or in film is you get to choose your family members.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, this makes so much sense. Yes.
Which is markedly different from the real family. So it's wonderful. It gives me a sense of being part of a family. And of course, you know, being head of a family.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing about running the National Theatre that sort of cured me of envy was that a large part of the job was producing other people's work. And so the success of the theatre depended, yes, partly on the work that I did myself, but largely on the work of other people. So I learnt the opposite of Schadenfreude, which Schadenfreude is taking joy in other people's disasters.
I learned
to take joy in other people's successes. And that was a transformative, and it sort of cured me of incipient bitterness, envy.
I wish there was a word for
that. We have to come up with a word.
We need a word for that.
We're going to work on that with our German friends, and we're going to get back to you on it.
I think there's a Jewish word.
Is there?
You know, I don't know that you need a word. Joy in other people's successes. There's.
I don't know. Maybe a little portmanteau. I don't know. I like a good word creation, Richard. I don't know. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's. It's a challenge.
I love that, to take delight in other people's successes. What a beautiful thing.
Gorgeous. A far too novel idea, I think, sometimes in the business. It's easy to, the compare and despair is just too easy to get into, and to consciously choose, you know, to feel joy and happiness for other people's success and understand like there's plenty of it to go around is, it's a really great approach.
I don't want to paint myself as saintly. I still.
Oh, we know you're not.
Feel, you know, pangs of jealousy. And
we heard you say fuck earlier, Richard. We know you're not saintly.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I think it's wonderful. Richard, in addition to your theater work, your film direction, your opera, your direction of opera, which you just referred to, on some of the world's premier stages, the other day you shared this great spark of an idea for an opera. I thought a great spark would be an opera of your film, Notes on a Scandal. And you came back and you said an idea for an opera that you had discussed was an opera about Donald Trump. We always encourage our listeners to take ideas they hear on the show and create things, and they really do follow through on that. So do you have any more sparkish ideas about this Trump opera that you would like to share with our listeners or any other great sparks?
Well, I was thinking, it's obviously a great tenor role. I was thinking
it might
be composed by a group of composers.
Oh my God.
Oh.
And
to represent some chaos and some dissonance.
Yeah. But it needs it just needs somebody to take it in hand and to run with it. And maybe the Met isn't the place, maybe it should be BAM that does it.
Yeah, something more experimental.
But it's absolute, a monster. Opera is a very good medium for to show tyranny and you get a chorus and this fatuous man presiding over a chorus of what was it? Hillary called it?
Oh, Basket of Deplorables.
Deplorables, yeah. The Deplorables, the chorus of Deplorables. I can see it being, and somebody, some great tenor in a fat suit. They're just great. I would love it. So.
Somebody get to work on that.
Somebody,
yeah, that's a hot spark right there.
Janine Tesori, John Adams, Philip Glass.
Yeah, yeah. The chorus of Deplorables. There you have it. That's a hot spark, friends.
Richard, you've done so much, including just discovered, publish a book of poetry. We're curious, is there a particular creative thing that you absolutely need to do before you're done?
I absolutely have to see the two plays that I wrote last year on the stage.
Yes.
And I don't know if you know a poem by Yeats, and I can't remember the title of the poem, but he ends the poem, call those works extravagance of breath that are not suited for such men as come proud, open-eyed, and laughing to the tunes. So for me, that's, that I don't want to do things that are just an extravagance of breath.
Yeah.
I'm old enough to feel that I want to be my work. I want to feel about my work proud, open-eyed, and laughing.
Mm-hmm. That's a poem called Vacillation.
Vacillation, exactly. Yes. How did you know that? Have you just looked that up?
Because I looked it up, baby.
All right.
Google. But please edit it, Susan, so it makes it sound like you just popped off that.
I love the possibility that I could have pulled that out of my ass, but I pulled it out of Google. There you go.
Right.
Oh,
okay.
Oh, my gosh.
But it's a wonderful poem.
So, Richard, you've been in the creativity business for a while, and you've made extraordinary things, and you've worked with extraordinary artists. Give us some good creative advice.
Well, I'd love to be able to say, ignore your critics. But, being subject to criticism is like being a lamppost subject to dogs pissing on it. It's just...
Very poetic.
It comes with the territory. You can't be, but on the other hand, don't take your critics too seriously. But the one thing I would say is just endure. Keep going.
Yes. Yeah. Oh. Keep going.
We love it. Keep
just
going.
Just talking about that love with it. Someone, it's like, my God, half the battle is just keep doing it.
I don't know if you know a play by Tennessee Williams called Night of the Iguana.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But the sort of spine of the play is the relationship between a whiskey priest and a aging spinster. And both of them have had nervous breakdowns. And the whiskey priest says to the spinster, how did you get through your breakdown? And she says, I endured by enduring.
Oh.
And so that is my advice, endure by enduring.
It's good creative advice, and it's good pandemic advice, too.
Yes. Sure.
And good life advice, yeah. I endure by enduring. Yeah, that's great.
I've got a question for you. This is one that we ask all of our guests. You, in particular, work very, very hard. What's it all for?
Oh, good Lord. That's what is it all for? Well, I guess because without it, I don't feel I do it. It's an existential urge. Uh-huh. I do what I do in order to make me feel that I exist.
Yes. I love
that's
it.
One of the best what's it all for answers we've had. That's really great.
And finally, Richard, who or what is sparking you these days?
My dog.
Yes.
It's true. My dog and my granddaughters, who are age 11 and 8, and they are sensational, and I worry. I see the world through the lens of their eyes and minds, and they are so bright and so not foolishly optimistic. But I desperately want the world to get better for them.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
God,
I love that.
What a great answer.
Oh my God. Thank you so much for being with
us
today. Like we are, this is just such a lovely conversation.
You're a bucket of sparks. You really are. We've written down several things that we're going to explore some Yeats. We're going to look at some films. You're truly a joy. You're really a pleasure to get to spend time with, even at a remove, even through a virtual portal. You're really something special.
Thanks so much.
They made you a knight. Yeah. So that's it. This episode of The Spark File was made on Muncie, Lenape, and Seminole land, and we hope it put another bunch of sparks in your file. Listen to us. If there is a spark that you'd like us to explore, or if you've taken a spark and you've fanned it into a creative flame and you want to share the light of that thing, won't you email us at thesparkfile@gmail.com or submit it through our website, thesparkfile.com.
We will even happily take your feedback, but you know the price of admission. First, you got to share a creative risk that you have taken recently.
And be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcast. Subscribe, rate, 5-star review it. It really does help people find it. And if you like this podcast, please share it with people that you love. And if you didn't like it, I don't know, Richard, what do you say to your critics, those critics that pee on your lamp pole? What do you say?
I say, fuck it.
Yay!
I love it. If something tickles your fancy and gets your creative juices flowing, we're writing you a forever permission slip to make that thing that's been knocking at your door. It's your turn to take a spark and fan it into a flame.
You got to take it
and
make it.
Bye.
Sir Richard Eyre, the best.
When I bump into something that inspires me, I dump it in my spark file. Could be something that I want to make or how I want to be. I pump it in my spark file. I jump into my spark file. Let's open up the spark file.